Welcome to Echoes Underground. In today's episode, we talk about the true function of alcohol. We start with Dionysus, the ancient Greeks' terrifying god of wine, and we end with the psychological consequences of monotheism. We get there via an in-depth discussion of what's truly happening in the ritual of after-work drinks. Follow us underground and enjoy. Why do you think that alcohol is important?
Why are we drinking it now?
Well, it's, obviously it's been used as a ritual drink for a long time. The notion of...
Quite strong.
The notion of intoxication. The Greeks had no word for alcohol.
It's Arabic, isn't it?
Yeah. They thought that the power of intoxication that was in the wine was the god, Dionysus.
In a literal sense.
Yes. Yes, I think that is the easiest way to conceive of it. Yes, that it is the power of the god manifest in the very tellingly named spirit. That is the god. Which is an interesting notion, but an entirely logical one if you're not aware that there is a particular chemical compound or how it acts.
Yeah, and I guess it must have been quite a confusing experience if you didn't know the mechanism. When I was in Yemen, occasionally people would sidle up to me and ask, what does alcohol do to you? How do you feel when you drink alcohol? Because all they knew about alcohol, because there's none in the country, really, is that it turns people crazy, almost like turns you into a werewolf. But you start doing mad things, things you wouldn't normally do, and you became something other than human. And this really, it was up there with what pork tastes like, but that was just that was pure taboo. Like, and they assumed that pork must taste incredible for it to be banned. But alcohol, it was a transformation.
I suppose it's it sounds like with what you're saying there that they almost conceive of it as a kind of possession.
Yeah.
And I suppose that you can immediately, you know, reach for a hypothesis there of why a religion would want to prohibit it, or at least why certain members of a religion would want to prohibit it, because it is competition, isn't it? If you are being inhabited by a divine force or a powerful force that is not the god that you worship, then you can immediately see how it's problematic within that scheme.
Yeah, in exactly the same way that psychedelics were problematic to the government in the 60s. We had built this great machine that was the US state, and then suddenly a whole lot of people refused to take part in it.
Well, yes, because of course it fills you with an ideology. The experience seems to have an ideology. It's a vector for an ideology, isn't it? When that ideology is that actually, you know, we should be nice to each other. The world's a nice place, and that subsuming your individuality into a machine in order to kill or be killed is in Vietnam is maybe not the way to go.
Yeah, although I guess it doesn't read perfectly across to alcohol, because alcohol, like after a pint and a half of beer, everything's very pleasant. You know, you're a nice person. Mm. But then that can switch over a couple of beers later. And some people get violent and aggressive under alcohol in a way that I don't think you see with the psychedelics. So there's an unpredictability to it.
You're right. I suppose, though, that in the sense that they are both a form of possession looked at in one way, because you become something that you were previously not. Or is it just an unearthing of things that are latent, or is it an amplification of traits that are there? Is it a reduction in self-control, or is it actually, does it have content? Does the experience have content that isn't already within you?
Comes back to the notion of possession. And Dionysus, was he predictable? Did he have a brand, as it were? Was he always a sort of chilled out good time guy? Or did he have
definitely
a dark side?
Not. Okay. Certainly not. The most, certainly to me, and I think to many modern scholars, the scariest god, because he very much represents an unbridling, should we say, or an unchaining of passions, and it very much has to be carefully contained within ritual, in order for that to be controlled socially. And, you know, you can look at it in lots of different ways. You can look at it from the kind of social construction or social regulation perspective, and you can conceive of Dionysus as the element that it kind of bucks against control and order, the more Apollonian thing, and therefore needs its own place and its own rituals in order for the steam to kind of be vented. Or you can view it as the completely unpredictable, the dark, the almost like the shadow of the subconscious, or the dark, uncontrolled, you know, monsters that lurk in the subconscious, erupting outwards at certain moments. And so you can see it as the uncontrolled element that's within all of us that has to be expressed from time to time. And but in a context where it can be managed. All of the myths are quite clear that if you try and fight him, it's not going to end well. It's really not going to end well. I mean, Pentheus, he's killed by, he's ripped to pieces by his own mother by hand, who believes he's a lion. And she carries his head back into the city, saying, you know, hooray, I've killed a lion. And then Dionysus allows her to see that it's her own son.
That kind of sounds half alcohol and half psychedelics, doesn't it?
There is that theory. There is that theory that actually, you know, the Greeks, there was much more than wine in the wine. You know, there's herbs and there's a lot of other stuff in there.
Yeah, and that needs digging into, doesn't it? Because, well, it says that some of the reports of drinking wine back then was you'd have to water it down 20 parts to one. And we know they didn't have distillation, so it wasn't a alcohol strength thing. But somehow this wine was getting its power. Well, it was powerful stuff that needed to be watered down 20 to 1. That's not alcohol, so there's got to be something else going on in it.
I think so. And they also drank it hot, so it would have been more of a mulled wine.
That would evaporate off the alcohol, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah. Yes. Yeah, possibly. There are lots of reasons to think that it might. I mean, for one thing, the ancient Greeks were extremely competent herbalists. You know, they knew all of the stuff that was around in the countryside, because of course they're living in that world. They are subsistence farmers, most of them, and they've been there for a long time, and they know the plants and what they do. It seems almost we know that there are psychedelics available in the Greek countryside if you know where to look.
They're in the English countryside. Mm. And not just the lippity cat mushrooms, but also there's DMT in the common reed.
Mm.
And we can see in the kind of early accounts of contact with the certain groups in the Amazon that their knowledge was... Well, what's interesting about it was not dead knowledge. It wasn't knowledge they inherited. And actually, when some of these groups were first contacted, the anthropologists were astonished at how few plant remedies they had in their arsenal. They might only have, you know, five or a dozen different plant remedies for very basic conditions. And they're like, these guys must be really primitive. They haven't worked out, you know, in the Amazon rainforest, any more medications than the simple selection that they have. And then 10 years later, they noticed they suddenly had hundreds of different remedies. And they worked out that these people were actually extremely healthy before they came into contact with Western civilization. They had far fewer diseases. They had a very healthy lifestyle. And so actually they didn't need much in the way of plant medication. So they just didn't have it. And as soon as they did suddenly need it, when they came into contact with us and caught a hold of new diseases and started eating, you know, less wholesome food, they went out into the jungle, and through their knowledge of the plants, turns out that they created new remedies from scratch through experimentation and through their knowledge of actually the mechanisms involved.
Which is remarkable, isn't it?
Because
it is not scientific knowledge, or at least it is not wholly scientific knowledge. It's not wholly empirical knowledge. They don't have the scientific method in order to build that knowledge.
Yeah, and nor is it just passed down wisdom that they just copy from their parents and their grandparents. They're able to make new knowledge.
And they're presumably conceiving of the relationships between the various different properties of these plants in a very different way from the way that we would conceive of it.
Yeah, and the combination is important, because it's not like you take one leaf and that cures this and another leaf and that cures that. Ayahuasca is a famous example where on its own it has no effect at all. You have to mix it with something else, and it's not obvious what that is. And it's not obvious that ayahuasca would have that effect if you mix it with something else.
Mm.
I mentioned common reeds, and you can't use that instead of ayahuasca. You have to mix it with something else. And just no one had done it, no one had thought of doing it. Because why would you? You know,
yes.
What are you expecting when you do that? But they got there somehow, and different groups use different admixtures to get to the same effect, because they have similar chemical properties.
And the way, of course, that we would imagine that happening is just through absolutely thousands of instances of trial and error. But then it's very hard to understand how that would happen without absolute carnage, isn't it?
Yeah, but also, why would you conduct these experiments in the first place?
Yes, you don't know. Well,
what are you expecting to happen?
Yeah. You don't know that there is an end goal out there that's successful. Yeah, I mean, absolutely, which makes it still very baffling.
Yeah, but also plausible that the Greeks knew what they were on about.
Yes.
With the plants that are available to you and I here, they'd see something very different.
But so going back to this idea of possession, I don't think alcohol serves the purpose of possession.
No. That's not my experience at work drinks.
No. No. Yes. It's much more about bonding, I would say. I think it is much more about the idea of building trust, actually. Because I think that with inebriation, you let your guard down a little bit, and you're a little bit more free, and you reveal a little bit more of who you are, and what's going on with you as an individual. And I think that if you do that with other people, that bonds you, because you've shared what is actually quite it's an experience with some risk. You know, if you've got drunk with someone, you are bonded with them, because you've both glimpsed. You've had a sort of a peek underneath the social armor, at least to a certain extent.
I think it goes even further than that, because when you're drunk, you're more likely to break some law or transgress some moral code, and you're certainly going to transgress the HR policies and acceptable office behavior after a few drinks.
Yes,
and that's fundamental to Chinese business. Like the reason why Chinese businessmen are so notorious for getting drunk is the idea is that they are, as a group, transgressing shared moral norms, both getting drunk and then what they do under the influence.
Binds them together.
Exactly, but yeah. And so there's a kind of threat that, yeah, you can now dob each other in and get each other into trouble.
Mm.
We've also seen what they're actually like under their professional shell.
I believe there's a concept, the ancient Greeks had a concept very like this, which I believe they called it a pistis. This idea that, a group of young noble men would deliberately go and commit a crime together, and quite a shocking crime. And this would then bind them together as a sort of political slate or as a political faction for life. And this was something that was, a well-recognized cultural phenomenon, even if not a wholly approved of one.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
My suspicion is that alcohol, at least one of its functions in our society, one of the reasons it's so important, is because it provides that, but in a quite a safe and low intensity way.
Yeah, exactly. It's something you can do with your office mates. Go out to a bar. It can still be official. It's still HR approved.
Mm.
And whilst no one's ever going to acknowledge why it benefits the business, it really does. And I think if you stop having these you know, office drinks, I think productivity will go down. Staff turnover goes up massively. People don't want to be at work, really.
And also the thing about alcohol as well is that you can really, really easily graduate it.
Mm.
So going to the bar does not mean you have to get absolutely wasted, because you buy it in these quite small units of increment. So you can go thinking that, well, I'm only going to have two, and that's absolutely fine. It's not like, you know, taking heroin where it's kind of a you're all in or not.
Yeah.
You can sort of dip your toe in, and you can retain a lot of control up until quite a late stage of how inebriated you are.
Well, and actually you lose a lot of respect if you can't control it.
Yes, which is another way of kind of sizing each other up socially.
Yeah.
You reveal more of yourself, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're the one that has to be put in a taxi and sent back home, like, you're not getting promoted.
No, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you are seeing, again, I think it's that idea of peeking under the social curtain or the social armour with someone, but also seeing what they're made of.
In the army, if you're joined to be an officer, well, on the last rounds of the interview process, it is a dinner where everyone has a bottle of wine put in front of them. And so, like, the test is to have a dinner party and there's a bottle of wine in front of you, everyone. And people are just looking and seeing what happens. And I think that's quite an interesting test. Just get out of the way up front, because if you can't deal well with that situation, you're not going to be a good person to fight with.
Yes.
You're prematurely making people reveal something they would never reveal under normal interview conditions, or even in a kind of, you know, teamwork exercise or physical training scenario. You're actually peeking under the bonnet.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Yeah. You're peeking under the bonnet. And I think that is why, I think that is at least one of the reasons why alcohol plays such an important part in our society, is because it is an absolutely crucial medium for that group bonding. Which is actually quite a banal point, isn't it? But I think there's a much more interesting thing going on about why that works.
Yeah, and actually, you mentioned the team bonding there, because most other inebriants, it's not really a team thing. There's less of a shared experience. I mean, you mentioned heroin. That's not a shared experience.
So I'm led to believe.
Yeah, I've heard.
Yeah.
Well, most of them, actually. I mean,
would you do, in one of the books I read recently, they were all going, there's some spitters of sci-fi books, some astronauts were going off to the, you know, some very distant to their place, and they each had a suicide method in case it all went wrong. And one of them chose heroin, because they were like, well, it's obviously going to be great. It's obviously the best way to go. Would you go in for that?
Yeah, if you had to. I don't know. It seems slightly cowardly, but then at the same time, you're probably allowed a bit of...
But see, one of the other astronauts decided to take a pistol, because he's like, well, if yours doesn't quite kill you, I'll finish you off before I finish off me, which is a very kind of dutiful and...
Yeah, exactly. And far less pleasant.
Yes. There's that element of selfishness in it, isn't there? Which is a... But anyway, I digress. It's very much a...
It's like Huxley being asked to have some... was it? LSD administered when he was on his deathbed.
Yes, I think it was mescaline, actually.
Yeah.
Is that the same?
I have no idea.
I don't think it is quite the same. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think that would be a very interesting experience. One assumes. I mean, of course, it's risky, because it could be absolutely horrifying.
Yeah.
I respect his kind of, like, commitment to... I suppose... I respect his commitment to... I don't know, what would you call it? Psychological, one's own introspective...
Yeah, exactly. He's been realistic about the situation, because no one ever expects to actually have to administer the suicide pill when you're, you know, on a deep space mission. You assume it'll be fine. And he's actually thought about it.
I think you'd assume it would be fine. I think I'd be fully expecting to have to...
Yeah, but I mean, if you're expecting it, you wouldn't get on the ship, would you?
Well, I mean, I think that... I'm not so sure. I don't know. I think that you could. I think that it's perfectly psychologically plausible to get on a ship thinking that odds are I'm not going to make it under certain circumstances. It depends what you're. It depends what you're leaving behind. It depends what your ideology is, and it depends what your motivations are. And,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. It'd have to be a strong reason. Yeah.
But alcohol. So there's that group bonding thing, which we've talked about. But I suppose the interesting question is that, well, is it the best choice for an individual intoxicant?
Well, and clearly not, because the alcoholism tends to be what happens when you make it a solo sport.
Yeah.
It's almost like alcohol in a group context is very healthy, but alcohol on your own
is not.
It's not. I mean, you know, a glass of wine after work, yeah, fine.
Mm.
But more than that, and you're going to get yourself into trouble.
Yes, very quickly. But that again goes back to the idea, doesn't it, of, you know, how do you culturally make sense of stuff like alcohol? It's dangerous, it's useful, it's powerful, and it's dangerous. And that's quite a... That you know, I think that's a common sort of triad of properties.
Yeah, but back to work drinks, I hate to keep bringing them up, but... Yeah, the fact is it's acknowledged that you will do the work better if occasionally you let Dionysius possess you as a group.
Mm.
If you don't have that, you'll be less productive.
Yes, the sort of the spirit of the animates a team, the esprit de corps.
Yeah.
But I mean, yes, I think that is right. You know, I think that's definitely true. But I suppose that with that out the way, that we can once again think about, well, what is it possession? You know, is that chap in Yemen right that it makes you into a werewolf, that it fundamentally transforms you, or that it fills you with something else? Or is it unearthing what is already there?
Yeah, I mean, my personal experience is it's unearthing.
Mm.
Or removing inhibitions.
But, I mean, that I suppose that is, in a sense, filling you with something from elsewhere. If you're thinking of, you know, your conscious self excludes a lot of the rest of yourself. Yeah, there's other stuff in there, isn't there, that is normally kept out of view, should we say, both of your own introspective consciousness and of the from what other people can observe. You know, I think that at least on one reading of the psychoanalysts and modern psychology, there are, in a sense, sub-entities within
us. Like your shadow and your
yeah, exactly, yeah. Or, but even just, you know, the sort of the lower brain systems have their own personalities, because they have their own wishes and desires that sometimes conflict with one another. You know, so you might have one part of your system sort of craving, you know, whatever it is, the donut or, you know, sex or whatever, but then another part of your system saying, no, that is definitely not what we need to be doing right now.
So you're saying that alcohol is a possession. But it's not a possession by an external entity, it's a possession by...
an internal entity.
Yeah, okay.
But then again, you see, so this is where I think that the best way to conceive of the gods is as internal entities, but as internal entities that are instantiated in all of us. And in that sense, they are universal, and they are, in that sense, you know, they are entities. They are coherent entities that exist across time and space. They've existed as long as we as a species have existed, and maybe even they're maybe even older. But then they don't exist sort of externally out in space. They exist in the pattern that is the human organism.
It's like a sort of step on from the shared unconscious is a sort of shared pantheon.
Yes, they're there in the blueprints.
Yeah,
you know, they're part of the blueprints, and they presumably serve a. They're either things that have coalesced through evolution, at the very least, or they actually do serve an adaptive purpose.
Well, yeah, if they weren't useful, they would have... Like, evolution would have got rid of them.
One assumes so, yeah. I mean, because you can have these sort of, you know, these sort of useless offshoots, can't you? That you're like the appendix and coccyx and so forth. But I think that it's an open question as to what precisely they would be if you accept this you know, this idea, even in the first instance, whether they are adaptive or not. But I actually think that's in a way that's a later question. I think the more interesting question is are they, you know, is it useful to think about gods or spirits in this way as entities that exist within the structure of our minds, you know, really genuinely within the structure of our minds, and as such, you know, they pre-exist us, they will exist after we're gone, they will be accessible, you know, they will be immanent to everyone with a you know, within the parameters of what we might call a normal human mind, and they're powerful because they are, you know, presumably they are there in response to the human experience and the human interaction with the world. Presumably they are there as a kind of shortcut, an adaptive shortcut for us understanding the complexity of what otherwise could not be understood.
Yeah, and so by giving it a name and rarefying it and almost turning it into a character, that helps us use it, or at least, yeah, the first step is to acknowledge it's there.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, you're not going to be a functional human being if you don't acknowledge you've got this bit in your monkey brain that wants to start fights.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you can start to have really interesting sort of speculation about, well, what happens then between the transition from polytheism to monotheism? Because you can kind of, in this, you know, if you accept this line of thinking, you can kind of start to see polytheism as, you know, the reification of a brain, but it's reified in this kind of fragmented and kaleidoscopic and slightly chaotic manner. And then once you transition over into monotheism, no, it's all brought under, much more brought under the sovereignty of perhaps the, I don't know, the ego.
Yeah, and that sort of, I guess you've got that theory that the two halves of the brain weren't communicating very well thousands of years ago, and so when one half was passing information to the other, it felt like a different personality, or, you know, an actual god speaking to you. But polytheism was quite recent. And so I find it hard to believe that the structure of the brain was different, or how minds work was different.
The brain is very plastic, though, isn't it? I mean, you know, the brain is... The brain doesn't require evolution to change. It changes according to the inputs on a time scale of very much a human life.
So what were the different inputs that...
Well, I mean, I'm really, really way beyond I've sort of...
That's where it gets fun, though.
what I've probably thought about and, you know, schematized here. But I suppose that you would think of it in the sense of that the mind, let's say the mind, would, by focusing on this idea that there is one unifying principle or one sovereign power within the universe, would organize itself such in a much more self-controlling manner. So, you know, presumably the networks would reorder themselves to prioritize the top-down nature of control or something like that. So you get more of a sense of your mind becomes more of the more of an individual in the sense that it's not divisible. You know, it doesn't feel like it's divisible. It feels like it's a coherent whole.
And more clearly demarcated, and so you almost lock bits of it out.
Yes, and you lock bits away, yes. So in order to make this happen, certain bits get locked away.
Yeah,
in a much more.
Not always healthy.
No.
But necessary, perhaps.
But perhaps effective in other ways. But yes, this is this is way beyond what I could, you know, really sort of empirically justify, or I'd have to really go away and think about it in great depth. But
yeah,
I think that other people have other people have had thoughts along this. This is definitely not my sort of original production.
Yeah. It's not quite like having multiple personalities, but a bit like that.
It's a bit like, I suppose the notion is that a genuine polytheist is very open to the notion that they want different things at different times and in different circumstances, and that they perform different roles at different times, and they kind of have multiple overlapping identities, which sometimes will clash with each other, but don't create a sense of psychological dissonance.
So an extreme example would be like berserkers. When you just get into that zone, they become something else, are you talking about something more subtle than that?
I mean, possibly. I'm just thinking of the most recent thing I looked into this, which is basically said that berserkers are basically a myth, that it didn't happen, but I don't know whether that's... I know what you mean, though.
The theory you've been going over makes it possible.
Yes.
That you can just unleash the...
You just unleash something, yes, yeah. and then it goes back in its box once it's spent. And, yeah. You know, but it's more kind of acknowledged, and it's there. And whereas, you know, for the monotheist, that stuff has to be stamped out, you know, it has to be denied, because it implies possession by a power that is not the one power.
Mm. Then you have the problem with soldiers going back for war, where they're having to be one very different thing out in Afghanistan than they are, you know, back at home.
Yes, and I think that the mind doesn't succeed in just being one thing. But I suppose that the idea is that it is much more motivated to try to be one thing under this system, and it does cause problems. Yeah.
Back to work drinks, is that you take your whole self to work, or just part of it? Is that, like, your work persona, yes, is different to your persona around your friends?
Yes. I think it's more that you. Because you're not seeing the whole person when you get inebriated, are you? You're seeing something more of them. You're seeing how they act. You're seeing how they have fun. And actually, of course, having fun and playing and joking is a really, really fundamental way that we read each other, isn't it? It's a form of play that actually is so fundamental for mammals to kind of scope each other out. This, you know, our mutual sense of humor, how we play. I think that element is, in a way, it provides a space for adults to play that they otherwise couldn't do. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does. I guess it used to be that you'd have a lot more sports at work, for example, which is part of that. But sports isn't quite play when it's organized.
No, because play is much more freeform, isn't it?
Yeah, and work drinks is freeform.
Yes. Like
anything can happen.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. I think, it is the way that adults play. I mean,
there's no goal. There's no... It's open-ended.
Yeah.
It's not a finite... There's no win condition.
You kind of construct an experience for yourselves over the course of the night, don't you? You kind of bootstrap a narrative.
Yeah. That you will refer back to in the future.
Yes, and it provides that bedrock of a relationship, doesn't it? That you shared that narrative experience in the same way that children do when they play. So, yeah, that's why if you're not an unfortunate person who's an alcoholic, you definitely should drink, because it's really, it performs a lot of functions.
Yeah, no, I'm glad we've solved that.
Yeah.